You're listening to Full Power Living with Eileen Dillon.
Have you ever been so ill in your mind, emotions, and spirit that it seemed nothing and nobody could reach you? My guest today, Zach Scow, was in this position in mid-2008, extremely ill and diagnosed with cirrhosis of the liver. Today, you'll hear his story and find out who or what was actually able to reach him and give him enough support and love for him to recover. It's a heart-affirming story and led him to found Marley's Mutts, which is reaching throughout the world to find, rescue, rehabilitate, and rehome dogs that don't matter. Welcome to Full Power Living, where we're dedicated to awakening the world to the power and importance of human emotions. You're listening to us on EmotionalPro.com's radio show page or on blogtalkradio.com/FPL. Don't forget that we also distribute by subscription through iTunes. Well, Zach Scow begins his story like this. He was diagnosed with end-stage liver disease in July of 2008. At this point, he didn't care much what that meant, only that he could continue living day to day as he had been. Constantly drunk, constantly numb. He explains in hindsight that his inebriated state was his baseline. This was his normal. He needed to be drunk to drive, to work, and certainly to interact with other people, especially if those people had new faces. Without alcohol, he was vulnerable and scared, much like the dogs he now rescues from shelters daily. A decision he made, and the love of dogs his father was fostering, led to Zach founding Marley's Mutts, dedicated to dog rescue, especially of large dogs. You can find out more at marleysmutts.com, MarleysMutts.com, and on Facebook at Marley's Mutts Dog Rescue. For now, however, we'll let Zach tell the rest of his story himself. So, Zach Scow, welcome to Full Power Living.
All right. That was quite an intro. Thanks a lot for having me.
Sure. I like to talk, too. I heard you do.
I do. Well, I'm notoriously long-winded, so if I go on a tangent, feel free to interrupt me.
Okay, great. Well, in October of 2008, you made a decision to give up alcohol, and I thought it was really fortunate that your dad, in whose home you were staying when you were ill, was fostering dogs. And I want to know.
Let's back it up. I really didn't make any decisions. I had nothing to do with my own sobriety. I really had nothing to do with a lot of my successes and the pivotal turning points in my life that have happened. Whether it be my sobriety, my emotional well-being, the positive things that have happened in my life did not come of my own will, my own volition, my own decision-making. A lot of them, most of them, all of them came from a power greater than myself, whether that be a group of people, a fellowship of people, my dad, my dogs, God, the universe, whatever you want to call it. Very few of them came from me.
Well, I'm glad you clarified that. In my research, it seemed, I had picked up that you did make a decision to stop drinking, but you didn't even do that. Is that right?
No, my liver failed.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, my liver and kidneys failed. So when you have end-stage liver disease, literally, I did everything I could to stay out of the hospital for as long as possible. So to give you an idea of how sick I was, I started to turn yellow in about March, which is jaundice, which means your liver is starting to fail. And then I started to get ascites, which is this condition when your tummy starts to bloat and get very swollen.
With fluid,
you start to get these varicose veins, too, in your tummy and elsewhere on your body. You start to get varicose veins in your esophagus because your liver isn't processing your blood and bile, and it's just pooling into the nearest vacuous space, nearest empty space, which is your stomach. And so what I would do is I'd just wear baggy clothes. I'd sit outside and tan so that I didn't look as yellow. I would wear sunglasses. So all these things are physically happening. I'm vomiting blood constantly. All of these things are happening to me, and I'm just playing it off like nothing's happened, like I'm not sick. People would recognize that there was something wrong with me, but I'd go into have my blood test done, and I remember walking out and very clearly and telling my, you know, I got my blood back. I'm an adult. My dad doesn't have to go in with me. I'm 28 years old. You know, my dad's not going in. I'm not getting a lollipop from the doctor, and my dad's sitting in there with me. You know, and the doctor says, you have liver disease, and you need to check yourself into a hospital immediately. And I walked out, and I told my dad, we're okay. We just need to stop taking Tylenol PM, and I need to start eating more healthy and maybe cut back on the drinking, you know. And everybody was so delusional. And, you know, when you have a family that abuses alcohol, that has abused alcohol for as long as we can remember, everybody's kind of delusional to a certain degree.
Mm-hmm.
You know, anytime when you are in a state like that, it's going to force your entire family to look at themselves, and they don't want to do that, subconsciously or otherwise. So, it was very interesting. So I did my darndest to stay out of the hospital, to stay out of that diagnosis, to prevent myself. Getting sober and removing alcohol from my life was the scariest, most fearful thing I can possibly imagine. And I did everything I could to prevent it.
So
I did not make any decisions. I got basically dragged into the hospital kicking and screaming.
I get it. Thank you for clarifying that. I've been a therapist, a psychotherapist, for 43 years, and one of the things that I've observed, or I see our Earth as a big, giant school, and we all have things to learn, and the universe doesn't stop presenting our lessons to us until we finally get them. And I'm impressed with how, if you were in my office, I'd tell you how strong and how stubborn you were to go to that length before you actually started to heal. Mm-hmm. So, but your dad, now correct me if I'm wrong about this, I think he was fostering some dogs at the time, and the dogs actually came to you and spent time with you while you were healing at his home. Is that correct?
Yeah. Well, I had started, it's kind of an interesting story. I started fostering dogs when I was still drinking. So it came from a very selfish motivation. My high school reunion was coming up, and my brother had just gotten his master's degree. One of my best friends had gone to Yale and was a professor at a school in Idaho. And everybody had all these wonderful stories for when we went back to this reunion, right? And so what am I going to say? I'm a drunk and I'm a drug addict.
Yeah, right.
So I started volunteering at the Humane Society. So, you know, I always loved dogs, and I loved that companionship. And I felt very alive. I felt very accepted. I felt very loved. And I did not feel okay. I didn't feel loved really anywhere else. I didn't feel accepted amongst people. You know, I could always find love in a dog's eyes, but the motivation was pretty selfish. I wanted to be able to go back to my high school reunion and be like, well, when people ask me what I do, I could be like, well, as a matter of fact, I'm a volunteer of some note at the Humane Society in my neck of the woods in Kern County. And I'd started the large dog foster program, which sounds like a mouthful, but it really isn't that big of a deal. It's just, we didn't have a large dog program. We just foster little dogs. And, you know, our entire program in this whole area of Kern County was little dog focused. We didn't have anything for big dogs.
Uh-huh.
So I started that before I got sick, started helping out with big dogs kind of one at a time. And then, I got sick. So dogs had always been part of my life up until I got sick. But then when I got out of the hospital after my stay in the hospital is when they really became a part of my life. I had rescued the three dogs that were at my house that became part of my recovery. I rescued from the Mojave Animal Shelter, Tug, Marley, and Buddy. I started with probably 2004 or 2003 through 2007.
So what was it about Marley? Because it was pointed out somewhere that Tug actually was the pack leader, not Marley.
Marley's the pack leader. That's
really?
Flip up. Yeah.
Boy.
Tug's a Labrador. Okay. Tug's kind of a...
Oh,
Tug's my boy.
I had a Labrador.
Tug loves me like nobody's business. But Marley is by far the pack leader. He's a Rottweiler pit bull. Very, very intimidating looking, but he's just my pack general. He's the dog that helps keep the symbiotic harmony. And and allowed me to bring in fearful, scared dogs from shelters. And,
okay. So
yeah.
When did this personal journey flip over into Marley's Mutts?
Well, what happened was I got admitted for a long-term stay at Bakersfield Memorial in August 3rd, 2008, and period, point blank, I needed a liver transplant. That was it, period. And as an alcoholic, you're not eligible for liver transplant without 6 months sobriety. And I was not going to make 6 months. They gave me an 18% chance of surviving 30 days without liver transplant. So they contemplated, you know, putting me on hospice care. They contemplated there was a lot of things, but, you know, surviving really wasn't one of them. They gave me a whole bunch of blood transfusions. They would give me frozen plasma transfusions to try and bring my numbers down so that I would be able to have proper biopsies. And we contemplated my twin brother giving me a partial lobe transplant. But again, you're not eligible. You cannot have any sort of transplant unless you're 6 months sober. And there was no way I was going to survive that long. I was just too sick. So the whole goal was to try and survive 6 months. That was the goal. It did not look like I was going to get anywhere near 6 months.
Who set that goal?
That's the goal that the American Medical Association sets. You need 6 months sober in order to qualify for a liver transplant.
Did you adopt that goal yourself? Because you said you didn't make decisions. Did you make a decision there?
I didn't really care. At the time I was sick, when I was in the hospital, I didn't really care much about anything. I got quickly addicted to Dilaudid and morphine in the hospital, and I really didn't mind much about what was happening.
A lot of people
try to give me credit for being strong. You know, oh my gosh, how did you make it through? You know, you were in the hospital for so long, and you persevered through. I was barely present in the hospital. You know, I spent 6 weeks in the hospital, and I just got sicker and sicker and sicker, and developed a very serious addiction to Dilaudid because everything is pain management related.
Right.
So they just give you, you point at it's an index. It's a well-known index for pain management. So there's a smiley face, like a normal face, a frowny face, and then a frowny face of crying. That's the pain management index. And you point at that frowny face that's crying, and that means that you are in a serious amount of pain, and then they give you the appropriate amount of medication.
Right.
And as a drug addict, all you got to do is point at that thing every time, and in 3 hours, they'll give you a shot.
Okay, so I'm going to go back to my question, which is, how did all of this flip over to Marley's Mutts?
Well, it's a long transition. So I finally got released from Bakersfield Memorial I got a consultation with the Comprehensive Transplant Center at Cedars-Sinai Medical Center. So the whole goal was to get me a liver transplant, to survive 6 months so that I could get a transplant. We couldn't do that in Bakersfield because they don't do liver transplants. They only do that at 7 hospitals, Loma Linda, Scripps Green, UCLA, and Cedars-Sinai. And Cedars-Sinai is where I was born. So we thought, all right, let's get me to Cedars-Sinai. You know, maybe my charm will rub off on some of the nurses or the doctors, or because I was born there, I'll have some sort of, they'll take pity on me, or who knows what will happen. But I got a meeting with Dr. Tram Tran, who is the assistant director of transplant and the head of comprehensive transplant. So they broke me out of the hospital against doctor's orders, had to literally pull every needle out of me, sign all the paperwork against doctor's orders, get me down there, feed me. I mean, I was the sickest sick person you could imagine. You know, me looking. I was yellow and purple and very skinny, and my muscles had atrophied at that point. And we got admitted into comprehensive transplant program. And basically, what that means is Cedars-Sinai, the best doctors in the world. They admit you. They evaluate your numbers, and it's their job to monitor you, keep an eye on you, and basically, one of the first things they did was take me off all of my medication. They took me off every drug I was taking. They took me off a lot of the unnecessary drugs that I was on at Bakersfield Memorial. And after a short stay there, they sent me home. And they said, stay near an emergency room because you're going to need to go. often. So stay near an emergency room, and you know you're going to and try and survive. So you're going to need to walk. You're going to need to eat a very, very, very strict diet if you can't eat, and survive. And
okay,
stay near
so
an emergency room.
So you obviously went along with this. What was going on that made you want to survive?
I didn't. When I got home, all I wanted to do was kill myself.
But you didn't.
I didn't. I got home. I got home, and the first thing that happened was, a series of trips to the emergency room for a variety of different medical problems. I went through full blown opiate withdrawal, which was a nightmare, considering how sick I was. And then I went through a period of wanting to just take my own life. And this is the first like week or so, and then a lot of just everything that could go wrong went wrong. Physically, everything. You know, I was reduced to a fetal state where I couldn't walk, I couldn't go to the bathroom, I couldn't change my own sheets, I couldn't change my own clothes, I had ammonia on the brain, so I couldn't talk right, I couldn't walk, I couldn't tie my own shoes, I couldn't do anything.
Right.
So there was nothing. I couldn't do anything. You know, and then things started to finally taper off where I could, you know, I started to see a little bit of clarity, and my dog's never left my side. So the whole time I'm going through all of this, I got Marley on one side, Tug on the other, and Buddy at my feet. Buddy's a Cocker Spaniel. He's at my feet. Marley's on one side, Tug's on the other, and they never left my side. So I'm throwing up in the bathroom. I'm sitting on my bed, and their body pressure is with me all the time. They're there every second of every minute of every day. And, you know, and my dad used to tell me when I was in the hospital, he would tell me this all the time. He'd say, son, you got to come home. I can't get Tug to come in the house.
Oh.
He said, ever since you left, I can't get Tug to come in the damn house. You got to come home. And that's what Tug's like. I mean, when that dog sees me, he loses his mind. And it's like every time I leave or every time he's, you know, he still has that bond with me. And that's what it was like. So, you know, when I finally got back home, those dogs just—it's like they got their paws on me, and they were like, "All right, listen here, buddy. Listen here. I don't give a shit what's going on with you, what kind of headspace you're in, how sick you are. We don't want to hear it. You're gonna eventually give in." And that's what happened. You know, after several weeks of feeling horrifically sorry for myself, because I can do that really, really well. I know. No issues feeling sorry for myself. I'm a professional pea potter.
So then it sounds like what your dogs were giving to you and what dogs are really good at giving was total unconditional love. They didn't care if you were throwing up or anything.
Yeah.
They just wanted you to be with them, and they wanted to be with you, and they wanted you to hang around.
No, there
right?
was this pivotal moment. Yeah, there was this pivotal moment where I was standing. This is kind of graphic, but I was standing this full-length mirror in my bathroom, and I'm looking at it, and I'm a relatively vain, you know, person, and I'm looking at it, and I'm 135 pounds, and I'm bright yellow, and I have this huge belly, and I'm purple, and I look so sick, and I just start crying, and I'm just weeping, you know, and I turn around, and I'm just feeling, I've never felt more sorry for myself, you know, and, I turn around and I look at, and Tug's just sitting there, and he's wagging his tail and he's looking at me like, I am the most gorgeous, wonderful, smartest human being on the face of the planet. Like, he doesn't have any idea. I'm just me. He doesn't see anything physically wrong with me. He doesn't see anything. He just knows that I'm me. He's looking at my soul. He's not looking at that I'm yellow.
Right.
You know, he doesn't know anything about that. He just knows that I'm me, and he knows that he feels that love that he's always felt for me, and he knows that I'm the guy that saved him, and he knows that I'm all those things, and he knows it all returned to that place.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what they were like every single morning. Every single morning they looked at me like, what are we going to do, Dad? You know, every day was just a new, brand new day. Every day just wagging those tails. What are we going to do? You want to go for a walk? What do you want to do?
Mm-hmm.
Now, every day was a new day that had endless possibilities. And my task, you know, the main thing I had to do was walk, and I couldn't walk far. In the beginning, I couldn't walk at all, but that's what I needed to do. And we live up here in the mountains, and I had a lot of work to do emotionally and spiritually that I really didn't know how to do. And so I you know, I started journaling. I used to just sit outside on the deck with the dogs and just kind of pet the dogs and watch the sunrise. And I couldn't sleep either. I had so much stuff going on in my head, and I didn't know how to be alive. I didn't know how to. Everything had come rushing forward. I've done
not
a lot
much,
of bad things in my life, you know.
Not much practice in living forward, right?
I mean, an emotional infant.
Right.
Emotionally an infant, professionally an infant. You know, I have the coping skills of a fetus, and you know, I just didn't know how. I was afraid of everything.
I have this idea, Zach. You were a demonstration project for God, that He could take somebody who was that infantile, as you just described, and make them into somebody who's actually effective in the world and a leader in the world. And when we get back from our break, I want to talk more about that.
That sounds like a plan.
Okay. So you're listening to Full Power Living, and we'll be right back.
As a parent, have you found all the parenting information you've been hearing lately a bit confusing? Are you having trouble sorting out the best response to your defiant child, or feeling hopeless about regaining respect from your teen, or determining whether your actions as a parent are the right ones? Instead of the usual pressures of parenting that you've been experiencing, you can partner with your child, raising incredible kids who are destined to become amazing adults. I'm Eileen Dillon, the Emotional Pro, giving you the opportunity to become the incredible parent for incredible kids. We have the method and the tools. You bring your optimism for learning and the kids. Raise Incredible Kids offers a comprehensive system for raising kids who are responsible, make their own great decisions, and become immune to peer pressure. To get you ready for this new era in parenting, get my free 10-page report, Incredible Communication That Helps You Create Incredible Kids, by visiting RaiseIncredibleKids.com now. That's RaiseIncredibleKids.com.
Welcome back to Full Power Living. I have a few announcements. We'd love it if you would sign up at emotionalpro.com to be on our mailing list. We'll send you our biweekly newsletter telling you about our programs. For example, next week we have a fitting follow-up to today's program. I'm talking with Carmen Harris, who's written a book called Shit Happens, Magic Follows. We're finding out today how Zach Scow has been dealing with the dung of his life, and next week we'll help you find out what you can do to live more magically in your own life. That's 9 a.m. Pacific time next Thursday, October 8th. And we want to thank you for helping us with our mission of transforming our world through the mastery and power of human emotions. So I'm talking today with Zach Scow, whose recovery from alcoholism and drug addiction and end-stage liver disease has miraculously
egoism.
led him to found and operate Marley's Mutts. And so you and your dad, you started fostering dogs. In this segment of the show, Zach, I'd really like, well, first of all, what's your reaction to my statement that you may be a demonstration project for God?
I think that is accurate, especially in reference to how we started off the interview. One of your first statements was that I had made a decision to quit drinking.
Wrong.
It parlays into the idea that I haven't made a lot of decisions, that God and however you want to define God, I define God as you know, all the beautiful things that compose this world. All of those things have made most of the decisions in my life that have led to the construction of Marley's Mutts and the development of all these wonderful things, including a lot of the decisions that I've made. I mean, sure, a lot of things are now intuitive for me that weren't intuitive before. I can make intuitive decisions that were not intuitive before. I'm not as fearful as I used to be of people, places, and things. You know, I also have always had a scaffolding of moral concepts and ethics that I knew how to follow through on. I just couldn't because I was addicted and because I needed, you know, my focus was elsewhere. They were trumped by something more powerful. But I would absolutely agree with that statement. Absolutely.
Good. All right. So the outline that I have is you've begun Marley's Mutts, which is essentially a large dog rescue operation. You're in Southern California near Bakersfield. You've got close to 350,000 people following your work. You 400,000. Yeah. All right. Everything on the internet's outdated. Okay.
We're actually more than just a dog rescue. We use our dogs to help rescue people. We have a program called Miracle Mutts where we, you know, every week take our dogs to dozens of different nonprofit organizations within our county as well as Los Angeles County and use our rescue dogs to help rescue people, whether that be people in recovery from alcoholism and drug addiction, people recently out of the penitentiary, people with autism, children with mental and physical handicaps, children in reading programs. We pioneered a reading program called Barks and Books. We do a whole bunch of different things with our dogs to help people with our rescue dogs. So it's not just a rescue rehab operation. We also spay and neutered 2,000 dogs for low-income families last year. So it's a lot more than just rescue.
Wow, that's a huge amount. Well, I have someone on the phone line here who's been following your work for a while, Marty, and I understand that she has some questions for you. So, Marty, are you there?
I am. Hi, Eileen. Hi, Zach.
Hi, Marty.
Hey. I just wanted to say it's an honor and a privilege to talk to you, Zach. I'm from Texas, and you have a following here as well.
awesome.
And I just want you to realize that you're quite an inspiration to a lot of people here. And I don't know if you ever stop and think about what a difference you make in other people's lives, and whether that's a positive or a negative pressure for you, but you're often the highlight of many of our days when we run across your post.
Well, that means a lot. I wish it meant more to me. If I have to be perfectly honest, I don't stop enough to drink that in. You know, I should. It should be the highlight of my day. It should be something that I allow to counterbalance the things that bring me down. But I don't know. I haven't learned how to absorb it properly.
We'll give you 10 seconds now, Zach. Just let it come in.
But I mean, everything—it's a learning process. I'm my own worst critic, and I've had a self-loathing. The self-loathing that I developed in my addiction was learned over a period of a long time, of over a decade. So, it's kind of that rut is so deeply worn that it takes a long time to get yourself out of that. So, accepting praise is not something that I do very well. And in many cases, you're right. It does have the opposite effect, where I read some stuff and I go, "Oh Jesus Christ, what are these people thinking?" You know, if they only knew me.
Hey Zach, how about considering getting past that it's about you at all that these comments come in, since you didn't make a lot of the decisions. The praise isn't for you; it's for that higher power. How about that?
Yeah, see, that's why you have a degree in
And I've worked for years.
That is a much better way to think about it.
Yeah, well, I think it's true, too.
Yeah.
But, you know, whatever, you accepted a job, and that job is now inspiring people, as Marty's been telling us, and you've been able to stand out of the way of all the decisions. How about standing out of the way of the praise and just let it go where it's supposed to go?
Yeah, more to think of myself as like a consortium of a bunch of different people and principles and ideas that have like happened to manifest themselves in myself.
That's because you made yourself available for whatever reason. So thank you, Marty. Do you have any questions you want to ask of Zach?
Well, about a dozen written down here.
Fire away.
Well, I guess I wanted to know, do you have a favorite rescue dog scenario and kind of why? What's the story behind the, or maybe the top couple that you really...
Of all the dogs, my favorite rescue?
Yeah. Has there been a favorite?
Yeah, I mean, Little Bear was one of my favorites for sure, because Little Bear had about 0.0005 chance of survival, and because we had so many people bad-mouthing us on the internet saying, you know, how dare you drag this whole thing along, and you're basically, you know, terrible people for, you know, taking people's money and spending it on this dog. You're doing it all for show. You're nothing but... We were trying to save this dog. I mean, Little Bear was a dog that I walked into the shelter. They were sitting in the lobby, this family. I could smell the dog, you know, this necrotic tissue, this rotting flesh. And I looked in the kennel, and here was this dog that had obviously old wounds. And I picked him up. He let me put a leash on him. He let me pick him up. And then he didn't want anyone else to handle him. And I took him. We took him to the... I had the people sign him over to me right there at the shelter, and we took him to the hospital, and, you know, it kind of only got worse from there. We had to cut away so much of his tissue and then take him to specialists, and it ended up being basically $16,000 worth of treatment, but we saved him, and it was against all odds. Even after the specialists treated him, the specialists were like, I mean, it was one of those things where it just kept getting worse, and you looked at his eyes, though, and you thought, you know, we still are going to hold on to hope, and not only did he survive, he's like the coolest dog in the world, and our great friend Dr. McDonald adopted him, who works at VCA, who treated him, and it just completely full circle, rad story, and he's just the coolest little dog, and he pees himself every time he sees me, and then Shadow is one of my favorite stories, because Shadow introduced me to my little brother, Robbie, who I love very much, and Robbie is, you know, Robbie had been in prison for 12 years, and Robbie's from my hometown, and Robbie had just gotten out of prison, and Shadow, you know, who had been my shadow for like 3 months, I didn't know how I was going to let her go. She had separation anxiety because I had been a dope and allowed her to get too close to me, and Robbie, you know, had been incarcerated for so long, was having trouble himself, you know, with the idea of segueing into life without bars. And so Shadow was the perfect fit for him. Each of them helped each other segue into life. And Shadow came from a terrible situation herself. She was found in a crate with two other dogs. One of them was dead and frozen solid. Fast forward 3 months, and we find out that Shadow actually has a 40 caliber bullet lodged in her lung. She'd been shot. That's why the other dog that she was found with was dead. Is that when they were originally rescued, she had been shot. So this is such a bizarre, unbelievable sequence of events that happened. Then we rushed her to the hospital via airplane, and we had to remove her lung, and we pulled the bullet out, and Robbie was there. We did it together, and now my boy Robbie has moved to Oklahoma, and he's a manager at an animal shelter in Oklahoma, and he's doing great. And he, you know, he's not shy. He's got a whole bunch of followers on Facebook. I mean, he's shy a little bit, but he's a success story. She's a success story. That's one of my favorite.
Well, let me come in here just a minute and ask you this, sure. Zach. That same kind of thing has happened for you, where you're not so concerned about meeting new people and so forth. What is it about being with the dogs that helps you move through that and not be afraid to be in the world?
Well, it's just practice. I mean, for one thing, it affords you practice. You spend a little bit of time with a dog, and you feel not judged. So it gives you, it puts your guard down. And as you, I'm just like people who use dogs as therapy animals in the world who need that kind of a segue. They provide that bridge, that social bridge, to help you with introductions. They kind of pacify a situation. For myself, for Robbie to a larger degree, you know, Robbie was very used to sizing up people in a situation. Anytime you'd meet a man, there was an automatic default kind of physical sizing up that you couldn't help. It was a subconscious reaction when you introduce. And it's like that for some of the men at the mission that we work with. They've been incarcerated, so when they come out, some of the natural reaction is to size up another man. But when you introduce a dog to the mix, it pacifies the whole situation. They start talking about their experience with dogs, and everybody gets taken down a peg. And like I said, for me personally, it just provided a lot of practice. It provides I provide you with that boost of self-esteem. Self-esteem, I would say, is what it is the key ingredient that dogs mm-hmm. provided for me is self-esteem.
Great.
And then if you really use them to their full degree, if you use a dog to for all of its the positive what they can really offer you, and that's exercise and boundaries and discipline and what they can really offer you in your life, they'll really provide you with self-esteem.
I would comment also that, like the story you were talking about two men, instead of sizing one another up, they talk about the dog. The presence of the dog allows people to pay attention to something other than their own ego or their own discomfort.
Yeah, totally. Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a very easy way to put it. I like to be convoluted and long-winded. You like to get right to the point.
I do. People don't like to pay therapists lots of money to not get to the point. So that's a deep groove in my brain.
Does that mean my career in therapy is over before it began?
Well, it depends on where the dogs take you. So, Marty, do you have another question?
Well, I would just like to say, when I see any of the negative press about Marley's Mutts, it makes me angry, too. And, I mean, obviously there's scam rescue sites out there, and people I know often are a little leery of donating. How can they be reassured that the money is going for direct care and rescue of the dogs to kind of help open up the floodgates? Because I know money is always needed in the organization.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Everything is transparent. I mean, everything is done through the IRS, and all of our tax returns are public record. There is a thing called GuideStar, and our GuideStar profile we're building up, which is a lot easier format for people to view. So I think we're like 3/4 of the way done with our GuideStar profile. And GuideStar is like the Facebook of nonprofits. So GuideStar, everything is vetted, and you can get on there and thoroughly view, you know, everybody's statistics. So we're just finishing up. You know, when you run a nonprofit organization that doesn't have many employees, we have like 4 employees, and we have 3 very large departments. So we have an employee for each of the heads of those departments and myself. So it's hard to get. We struggle to follow through on some of these larger tasks, but I mean, everything we do as a nonprofit is public record. And
so that ties in, Zach, to the Mutt Militia, because you do have some people who regularly do donate, and they step up and foster dogs. And talk about the Mutt Militia for a minute, please.
Yeah, I mean, we like to put from a marketing standpoint, it's always great to put a name to the people that follow you, but everybody has been so kind of militantly supportive of what we do and the principles that we try and push forward, which is, you know, supporting larger dogs. Because it's really easy to rescue smaller dogs, because if they get in squabbles, it's not that big of a deal. You know, you can just squirt them with a water bottle or whatever. Small dog rescue is a completely different struggle than is large dog rescue. And we don't discriminate when it comes to breed, and we don't discriminate when it comes to malady. So if a dog has something wrong with it, whether it's a broken leg, you know, right now I'm laying next to Hercules, who is a black 3-legged pit bull. So he's got the trifecta of things going against him, which is that he's black, he's a pit bull, and he has 3 legs. So the Mutt Militia supports us in all of our endeavors, and without that support, we wouldn't be able to do anything. That support is crucially necessary, and it's been able to help us branch out and go, you know, into the Miracle Mutts program and become more than just a rescue, a rehab kind of a organization. And really, what it is there are fosters. I mean, we don't have a location. We don't have a rescue center. You know, we've been saving up money for a long time to try and accumulate enough to buy something like that, but it's incredibly expensive, and we haven't been able to get there yet. We're still in the process of working with a developer. We're working on something right now that I think should bear fruit soon. But But there are a lifeline. I mean, they are the composition of our organization. They are our lifeblood, excuse me.
That's great. Well, Marty, I want to ask you a question. Zach, you mentioned that some people were militantly supportive. And Marty, you said you get angry about some things that are said about Marley Smuts. What makes you, what is it about Marley Smuts, Marty, that makes you fiercely supportive of them?
Well, you can see in the post Zach's sincerity. You can see the far-reaching influence that he's having in the world. I mean, I don't know much about his recent trips to Korea and the meat trade there, but it's obvious that he puts the animals ahead of his own self, and you can tell that in his mannerisms and in his actions. So, you know, in a world that's so cynical right now, it upsets me that people can't see him and his organization for what it is.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I get frustrated with myself sometimes because I feel like, am I somehow putting forth some sort of disingenuous vibe? Like, why am I getting picked on? Because like I told you before, it's easy for me to feel sorry for myself. I can fall back into that pattern easily. And so I wonder, you know, what is it about? Am I giving off some sort of fear that is making me a mark for people like this? You know, everybody takes vacations. You know, a lot of people. I mean, recently I helped a friend who is handicapped go to Africa. Her husband lives in Africa, so she asked me to help her travel to Africa. She also hasn't been on vacation for, I don't know, like 2 decades, right? So I helped her go to Africa. And then the next thing you see on, I can't afford to go to Africa. She paid for it. It was great, and we had an awesome experience. It was the best. It was one of the best times I've ever had in my life. I've never smiled and felt so genuinely at peace than in Africa on that trip. You know, it was wonderful. And then the next thing I know, I'm looking at this nonprofit review site, right, where they like review nonprofit organizations. And sure enough, you know, there's like 3 comments. It says, don't donate to this organization. The director uses the money to go on extravagant trips to Africa. And then there's like 3 comments that are like, yep, I heard the same thing. That's bullshit. And then like with 3, was this comment useful? And 3 thumbs up. I'm going, wait a minute, you got to be kidding me. You know, where do these people get this stuff? And why would you pick that? I just don't understand it. You know, it doesn't. Uh-huh. To me, and you can, it goes with being vulnerable. I mean, I don't want to change the way I am. I mean, the being vulnerable about my addictions and being vulnerable about who I am is the reason we are as big as we are. And I don't want to change that. And in many ways, I want to continue to do that. I want to be louder about that because I like living wide open and it keeps me honest, you know. But then it sets you up to really get kind of picked on. And to be quite honest with you, emotionally, I haven't been in the greatest shape the last year. I've kind of had my legs taken out from under me. And going on that Korea trip, I was in real bad emotional shape. You know, I had my heart broken and was on that trip and not sleeping at nights and trying to focus on work. So when you're working such a difficult, you're seeing dogs assassinated every day and working in that kind of, I mean, going to Thailand and watching what happens there was terrific, and watching the work that the Soy Dog Foundation was doing in Thailand was outstanding. Work in Korea was difficult, and a lot of the travel was tough. And but to really work towards something that you think is powerful and worthy and a cause that you really believe in and that you hope other people will latch onto and want to make a difference about, and to have other people badmouth you for that. Like you're just like globetrotting is, I mean, we worked like 14-hour days and I didn't sleep. I think I averaged like 3 hours of sleep a night and I was traveling every day. But I think I just got to suck it up. I think a lot of it has to do with just me sucking it up, paying attention to certain people. I think I got to toughen up.
Well, you know, you bring to mind, Zach, I'm a professional speaker and a member of the National Speakers Association. And many years ago, in our local chapter, we had a woman come and speak to us who was a rally speaker who worked for Disney. She'd speak to thousands of people at a time. And she told us that she had no problem speaking to thousands of people at a time, but put her in a room with four or five people and she was all thumbs. And I'm like the opposite. And she said that 5% of all of her audiences hated her. And I thought that was interesting, because when you give a speech and you get feedback, you tend to concentrate on the negative feedback. But in reality, that's only 5% of the people. It's not a big portion. And you can choose attention to other things, like the fact that you were able to rescue a few dogs out of Korea, and that you will be able to do things. And you did share with many people in the world that there is a dog meat trade going on, and yeah. And that's really, really powerful. If you have to have a few insults based on that. Oh, and I'll tell you one other thing. As a therapist, I've learned that people usually accuse others of what they themselves do.
Oh, projection is like usually so. The culprit. The other thing, I had a pretty decent epiphany the other day. I think I reached my complete emotional and maybe even like moral bankrupt rock bottom when I kind of reverted back to old behaviors and had this just real terrible almost altercation with somebody, and I realized that I was just so miserable that I became that guy that is so miserable that he behaves miserably in publicly miserable.
Mm-hmm.
And I became that guy who decides to not only be miserable inside but go ahead and be publicly miserable. Like where other people are observing you be miserable, and they go, Jesus, look at that guy, you know? And I thought, like, shoot, you know, everybody's human, and maybe those people are just miserable, and, you know, maybe you should just chalk it up to that and quit whining.
So what's the great, besides you coming out of your illness, now let's move on to one other thing. I watched a video in which you told the world, I think it was around September 8th or 9th, that you had been tested. You had a cirrhotic liver. Now, cirrhotic liver is a scarred liver, and most people who have cirrhosis don't ever recover. I think you said there was a 5% chance.
Yeah.
And you got news. You know, can you talk about that news and what that's meant to you?
Yeah, so what I was told when I first became a comprehensive transplant patient is I have acute, you know, significant cirrhosis of the liver, which is a result of acute alcoholic hepatitis. So when you have end-stage liver disease, you have significant cirrhosis of the liver. That's hardening of the liver, it's scar tissue. That stuff never gets better. So you have a big chunk of your liver that's not really functioning. You hope that the part that is functioning stays healthy and that the cirrhotic portion doesn't continue to progress. Usually it is a progressive illness. Cirrhosis of the liver is progressive. That's why you are enrolled in comprehensive transplant, is to keep you alive and try to keep you healthy, try to keep you well enough so that when it does get worse, you're ready for your transplant. That's why I'm enrolled. 5%, they tell you that 5%, and this wasn't until like 3 years in, they told me, or 4 years in, they told me that 5% of cirrhosis patients actually have the potential to reverse their cirrhosis. But they very rarely see it because cirrhosis patients, you know, and not reverse it completely, meaning they can, you know, partially reverse their cirrhosis. 5% of the patients have the potential to do it, but we don't see it very often because lifestyle, you know, doesn't improve. They still either drink or use drugs or don't, you know, their diet isn't well or they don't exercise. Or in many cases, it's age. You know, I'm still relatively young. I just turned 36. So, but that was really good news for me. So I just kept doing what I was doing. You know, I run the Chicago Marathon on my sober birthday every year. Can't do it this year because I had back surgery. Most likely from running the marathon. But what, so on my last, I have these two, I have a biannual review. at Cedars every year, where they go over all my numbers. I have to have an endoscopy, a biopsy, all these different imaging as part of my enrollment in the program. And so we sit down, my doctor and I, we go over all these numbers, and then Dr. Ayoub says, "Well, hey, why don't we do a fibrosis scan?" And I'm like, "Well, what the heck, what is that?" He goes, "Well, it's this new machine. I think it's open, meaning no one's using it right now, and it shoots a concentrated ultrasound into your liver, and we can find out what your your cirrhotic number is. So in other words, how well your liver has healed, because he had done they feel your liver." And he's like, "Man, I don't even feel anything. You feel great. So let's do a quick scan and see what you're at." I'm like, "Well, shit. All right." I got real nervous real quick, like, "Oh my gosh, what is this?" Because I've never had a official biopsy, to see what, when they do a real biopsy and cut you open, they can see.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going, "Oh my God, all right, let's do it. Let's see what happens." And so the first shot he shoots in, it taps you, and then it shoots this. So it's kind of a funny feeling. It's an interesting feeling. And it comes back like 26. First of all, if it's 12 or higher, you have cirrhosis of the liver. If it's 12 or lower, you don't. And it comes back like 26. And he's like, "Oof. Have you had surgery recently?" And I said, "Well, yeah, I had back surgery." He goes, "Okay." So what it did was it picked up on my back surgery, my scar tissue from my back surgery, which is right below my liver. So it was picking up on that scar tissue and bouncing that back. So he did the scan again, and it came back 8. He did it again, 8. Did it again, 8. So that means I don't have cirrhosis of the liver.
Wow.
So I'm 4. I mean, most people are probably in the 3 to 6 range, but I am below the threshold of cirrhotic, so I no longer have cirrhosis of the liver.
Congratulations. Wow.
Yeah. Which it means I got to start writing my 5 to 10 year plan.
Yes. Yeah, looks like you're going to make it.
Yeah. All this subconscious wishing that I don't live to be 50, shit has got to stop, and I have to really start thinking about a future.
Well, apparently that's because a lot of people and a lot of dogs are relying on you. Let me get back to Marty. You're still there, Marty?
Yeah, I'm here.
Do you have anything else you want to ask Zach? Or maybe you want to comment on all of this based on your profession?
Yeah, well, a couple of things. I hope you eventually address how as individuals out here can help you or things that we can partake in going forward. But what Eileen's, I think, alluding to is she knows that I'm a nurse.
Yeah.
And I guess from a medical perspective, I'd like to know how we as a medical profession can do a better job of helping patients like yourself make changes or help to see changes. And I guess from a medical perspective, too, I'm curious, when you have those emotional kind of dips, what keeps you from slipping back into that, those patterns and addictive lifestyle now?
Yeah, those are good questions. So, I mean, do you have experience specifically with patients with cirrhosis of the liver?
No, I don't. I don't.
Oh, okay.
I mean, I've been a nurse for 35 years, so, I've taken care of medical surgical patients, but I'm actually on the other end of the spectrum now. I'm a lactation mother baby nurse. So,
okay.
No, it's. But still, in our profession, a lot of times we run across individuals in all aspects of their life where they're struggling. We have mothers, brand new mothers, that come in cocaine positive, their babies are cocaine positive, or fetal alcohol syndrome situation, CPS,
Yeah.
So I'm just wondering from a medical perspective how we could listen better or help people make changes in their lives, I guess.
Well, the best thing that ever happened to me was getting involved in a fellowship, getting involved in a program. I had to be involved in, nothing was going to come of myself. I had to talk about, I had to relate to people who could relate to me. And in some cases that couldn't be a nurse. That had to be somebody who knew what I was dealing with. The first meeting I had was in the hospital. And in that meeting, there was a guy that had gotten through end-stage liver disease in prison. So my first meeting that I had was all this guy. He had hepatitis C from intravenous drug use, but here he was, and it was the first glimmer of hope that we had had. All my dad had heard from the three GI doctors that I had was, your son's going to die unless he gets a liver transplant, and he's not going to make it 6 months. So basically, you're up shit creek without a paddle. And it was so demoralizing because my dad's an engineer, so all he's looking at is these numbers, and all the numbers keep coming back, you know, terrible. But you know, we reached out to the AA central office in Bakersfield, and they sent us these three guys, and one of them, he's a proof positive in the flesh human being standing at the foot of my bed, and he was end stage, and he's in front of me, you know, and he did it in prison, so I can't imagine what the hospitals are like in prison, but they're probably not very good, you know, and he's alive. So maybe we got a chance, you know, and that was the first piece of hope, and those are still the people that are the closest to me in my life. I still have the same group of friends that I did when I was in grade school, so they're obviously very close to me. But support groups are hugely important in order to not feel lonely. Loneliness and feeling like you're tragically unique will always lead you to relapse or try to seek comfort in your old ways.
So those people and the dogs offered you the same thing. They kept you from being lonely. They accepted you for who you are.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That's wonderful.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, one of my best friends like to use this phrase that I'm an egomaniac with an inferiority complex, and that I don't think much of myself, but that's all that I can think about. and it's very true, you know. And I think a lot of us are that way. And it's very easy for us to get that way unless we have people to talk to help us pull our head out of our own ass. And those are patterns. Those are learned patterns. Now, a lot of us have those patterns, you know, from something that happened in childhood. Our subconsciouses are weird. The subconscious is a weird, tricky part of the brain. You know, we have experiences in our lives that we don't even know about that affect our confidence, our self-esteem, that can rear their ugly head, and we don't even really realize it's happening.
Mm-hmm.
But talking about it can release it and let it free, and then you can move right on. You know, there's some simple tools that if you just use them, but you have to know about the tools first, and then there's the willingness to use them. I'm incredibly stubborn when it comes to, I have like an arsenal of tools, of spiritual tools, of emotional tools. I have a war chest of weapons, of tools that I throughout the years of sobriety and the people that I've talked to, and I still hesitate to use them because I'm stubborn, because I still want to rely on me, which is ridiculous, because I've proven time and time again that relying on me doesn't get me anywhere.
Although, I will just put this in, that you have amply proven that you're willing to rely on something larger than yourself, and that may be even better.
Oh, yeah. My intuition, my intuition's ability to be willing to rely on something greater than me has saved my ass more than I can count.
Yeah.
For sure. Yeah.
Okay, good.
Yeah,
well, to follow up on Marty's suggestion here, I made a brief list. People can get involved with Marley's Mutts. They can go to Facebook, which is Marley's Mutts Dog Rescue on Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
They can donate. They can
button on Marley's Mutts Dog Rescue.
Okay, and they can become a member of the Mutt Militia.
Mm-hmm.
What else can people do?
You go to
marleysmutts.org
is our website. You had said marleysmutts.com on the intro. Either way, it'll redirect you to marleysmutts.org. But marleysmutts.org is the website. You can set up various different donation plans. You can also, monthly, you can make just an initial donation. You can there's a variety of ways you can do that. You can also talk to your employer about setting up a donation plan. If you use Amazon a lot, you know, if you use the Amazon Smile program, you know, you can donate through your Amazon. You know, we're recognized through them, so it's a pretty easy process to, if you purchase anything through Amazon, just go ahead and register, click on Marley's Mutts when you register Amazon Smile. That's a great way to donate. We also have an Amazon wish list with a lot of our just crates and cleaning products and stuff that we need to keep the rescue going. you know, BMWs, Africa trips, stuff like that.
You've already got the Africa trip. Come on.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I tripped to my homeland. Denmark trips.
Okay,
no,
good.
And yeah, so there's and really just following us on Facebook and on like Instagram and stuff like that is a great way to keep up. We're very interactive, so we always have things happening. There's always stuff going on. There's always some really powerful stories that are happening, good and bad. We try and one of the things we try to do to separate ourselves is keep things positive. If you focus on the rescue world, almost everything is kind of a more negative focus, which is like kind of more murder, death, kill. You know, this dog is going to die in 90 seconds if you don't do something, and it's in red, bold letters. Hmm. And we try to focus on, while not, you know, deluding ourselves, we try to focus on the reality, but try and tell the positive stories. And really tell it like a soap opera, like a real story. I mean, these stories are terrific. They're stranger than fiction. They're wonderful, and the families are wonderful. The people that contribute to make save these dogs' lives are just like you and I. They're all just real hardworking families that live in Bakersfield. Bakersfield, Kern County is a poor county. You know, this is not a rich place, but it is per capita the most giving place in the United States of America. I mean, you'd be hard pressed to find a more giving county than Kern County. I mean, I think our average donation is like $7, so we make it work.
That's wonderful. Well, there is so much more we could talk about, Zach, but it's time to close this down. I just want to say I'm an animal lover and a dog lover. The whole time I was writing my script for today, my dog sat next to me, and I was certainly appreciating dogs. So I want to thank you for your work and your dedication and your openness to listen to that, whatever it is that's larger than you, whatever you wish to call it. Okay. And I think that Marley's Mutts is an amazing program whose time has obviously come. So I am appreciative of the fact that you put your energy into it and that you care about some dogs that just are perhaps really hard to care for, and yet a little bit of care, just like care for humans, goes a long, long way. So I want to thank you for what you do.
Yeah, you're welcome. I want to thank you I definitely took something away from your very calm, concise advice, and I will not forget, you know, to think about myself as an amalgamation of a lot more than just my ego.
Oh, great. That's wonderful. And if you'll, I'd like to talk to you a few minutes after the show, if you'll just hang on the line here as I sign off. And Marty is the person who is responsible for me inviting you to be on this show. And Marty, I want to thank you for bringing Marley's Mutts to my attention, and also for coming and asking your questions. I wish we could have gotten to more of them.
Hugs, Marty.
Hi. Yeah. Well, I'm just glad that you had him on your show and just really impressed with the honesty that he shares with all of us about, this great mission that he's
in the middle of.
Wish I could
give you a big fat hug.
Oh, I love it. Yeah.
And California, Texas hug.
Yeah. And I, too, have two dogs, so I'm a lover as well.
Well, I'll get your information, and we'll have to send you out like a mutt package.
Oh, that's very sweet. Thank you.
Yeah, we'll do that.
It was a pleasure.
All right. Thank you, Marty. Great to have you here. So join us live every Thursday at 9 a.m. Pacific time, noon Eastern, for more powerful experiences here on Full Power Living. And don't forget October 8th, next Thursday, I'm talking with Carmen Harris, who's author of Shit Happens, Magic Follows. And I know you're going to want to join us for this show. And if you have show suggestions like Marty did, please send them to me. Paul Johnston of Fresh Talk Media has been our producer today. Thank you, Paul. For now, I'm Eileen Dillon, your host, reminding you to pay attention not to what you want to overcome, but to what you want to become.
Living with Eileen Dillon.